BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Thirty years ago, a young woman was stopped at customs in the Hall of Rome Airport with Masonic documents inside a false lining of her suitcase. As the Italian customs officers read through these documents, their eyes widened. This was the proof of what Italians had long suspected. Translated into English online for the first time this week, the plans for the Grand Orient Masonic Order of Italy to take over newspapers and political parties in what they called the plan to renew democracy. It was, of course, nothing of the sort. It was, in fact, a programme to take over politics of the country and destroy allegiances that were being made by the Communist Party, basically to reintroduce a Mussolini-style rule by fear. The Masons in Italy had been running an invisible parallel government of traitors and would use their own secret services, military intelligence, to kidnap and kill their political rivals, kill their own people, and fit up for these high-level political assassinations and other crimes, domestic left-wing radicals and the Russians even. Plus, will there be a bomb at the Olympics? The army have made that less likely than the G4S after the G4S shambles, but nevertheless, if the unthinkable does happen, who might benefit? Plus, when the mainstream media tell us who it was, how can we tell who really did it? Plus, the Washington Post this week is saying the Free Syrian Army is creeping back and forth across the border and using NATO's Turkey as a base. Syrian rebels have also been coming to the Turkish border to get bigger and bigger and better weapons. So the conflict is looking rather less like a genuine uprising. And I think that's where we'll start this week with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, we have seen from this Washington Post article that the headline of it is that Turkey is a hub for the Syrian revolution as illegal border crossing points abound.
Yeah, I mean, they're talking now about the idea of setting up safe havens, as they did in Bosnia, which of course then allows them to use air power to protect the safe havens, leading to an overthrow of the Assad regime a la Libya. But as the Russians have pointed out this week, you are not talking about peace, you are talking about war. You're arming one side in the war. You're saying that Russia is arming Syria. In actual fact, we're not. But we've got a lot of advisers inside Syria advising the Syrian army, and you are supplying weaponry to the other side. Now, the West, the Russians are saying there's no basis for a humanitarian intervention on this basis. Unless you stop supporting with weaponry one side in this civil war, then we're not going to take seriously your concerns for humanitarianism, not least because the Free Syrian Army have been shown to be carrying out massacres like the Hula massacre. The German press have been very hot on this. They carried out a massacre of regime supporters and then brought in Western journalists to say, oh, look what terrible things the Assad regime's doing, even though the people dead were Assad regime supporters. And that's all been very much covered in the German press, but not in our press, which is more controlled.
Now, on Wednesday, Turkey, this is from this Washington Post article, Turkey closed all of its legal border posts after Syrian rebels assumed control of them, the crossings on the Syrian side. The move was prompted in part by concerns that Islamic extremists may have overrun at least one of the Syrian posts at Bab al-Hawa after a video posted online showed jihadi figures there and fighters declaring they had established an Islamic State and they were now controlling the border.
Yeah, well, it's not clear what the opposition to Assad actually adds up to. There's more than one organisation involved, and there's more than one foreign country involved with backing their protégés. Well, it's very messy.
One of the peculiar things about this, of course, is that Al-Qaeda, up until what it was about a year ago, were our sworn enemies, and now it seems... Particularly, maybe going back to the days when the CIA, back in the 1980s, actually created Al-Qaeda in the first place to fight in Afghanistan. So to what extent can we look at Turkey and Erdogan and the Turkish government as actually being genuinely trying to stop the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in that part of the world?
Well, don't forget, they are moderate Islamic fundamentalists themselves, and they're Sunnis, so they do have some sympathy with the Sunni uprising inside Syria. But of course, the other thing is Assad's threatened is I could unleash the Kurds on you, Erdogan. Because you kill 30,000 people. That we don't get told about this in the Western media. We get told about terrible Syria, but terrible Turkey. They've carried out massive repression in the Kurdish part of Turkey, which is nearly half of Turkey. Killed 30,000 people, died in the fighting. And Assad's saying, well, I might start supplying weaponry to the PKK, and they can start whacking your soldiers inside Turkey. And the Lebanese army will support Assad, because the Hezbollah-led government and the Michelin of the Christians, they support Assad. The Iraqi government supports Assad. So all of these people have been trained by British and American soldiers, the Iraqi army, they might come in on the side of Assad. And did you see there was a massive series of bombings supposedly by Al-Qaeda in Iraq last weekend, killed 100 people in Shia areas of Iraq. Now, of course, from the Shia-led government in Iraq, they see this uprising in Syria as the same as their rebels, their Sunni rebels inside Iraq. And in actual fact, it's the same people crossing the border. So we've actually got a maelstrom of chaos here. And the Russians are quite right to say to the West, step back and stop pouring petrol on this bonfire.
So what is the situation with Turkey? Is it really what Turkey's doing in its own interest, national interest? Or is it really...
Well, hang on.
Is it really just more of a... Because, I mean, it's part of NATO. To what extent is this, you know, Turkey's own doing? And to what extent maybe it be a NATO operation? Because we can see from a lot of the news stories over the last week that the Syrian rebels have actually been coming up to the Turkish border, getting re-equipped with weapons there and going back to the fight.
Yeah, I think it's partly to do with Erdogan's predilections. He's a moderate Islamic fundamentalist, and he'd quite like the Sunnis to take over in Syria. And it's also because that's the NATO position. Basically, they are supplying weaponry to the resistance, if you want to call it that, inside Syria. Now, maybe that's justified, but the West, of course, is pretending that they're honest brokers when they're not. They are, in fact, participants. And, of course, if I was the Syrians and three of my top generals were killed in a bomb attack, with probably being helped by maybe British or American intelligence, maybe it's time to blow up some British generals while they're having tea. Because that's the only language they understand, apparently.
Well, it was announced in the Daily Mail last weekend, and then copied up onto the Iranian channel Press TV, that the UK are using special forces to train Syria's armed rebels, including those who were in Damascus a week and a half ago, and potentially, anyway, responsible for the killing, the bomb attack on the two generals. So this is an admission that former SAS soldiers, the Daily Mail admitted that leaders of the armed terror groups in Syria have been trained by former SAS soldiers, as it claimed the government of the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad will be toppled within 4 weeks.
Well, if I was Bashar al-Assad, I might come to Herefordshire, where the SAS are based, and do some killing, because that's the only language they understand, isn't it? The IRA used to do that, and maybe that's what the Syrians have got to do. Just man up and get fighting. And the Palestinians, of course, there's obviously no point negotiating with the Israelis. Waste of time. Let's get out there and kill some Israeli soldiers. And so, they're all soldiers, actually, so if we kill civilians, it's a democratic country. Let's just get going. Oh, yes, while we're on, we've got to get rid of those regimes in the Gulf, so we've got a mass uprising in Bahrain. The Iranians should be supplying the Bahraini people with Semtex and anything they need to start killing people. Let's go for it. Let's have a full Middle East war. That's what the West wants. Maybe we should have it. And then they'll lose. And then they'll wonder why they did it. But that, by that time, it will be far too late.
Well, speaking with the state-run BBC, this is continuing from this Press TV report. Speaking with the state-run BBC on Friday the 20th of July, William Hague said Britain should be acting outside the United Nations Security Council and intensify its work to support the terrorists in Syria who target its government officials.
Well, Britain is playing with fire here. And what worries me about Britain, we're not like the Americans. We don't go round cheering when we invade places that we don't even know where they are. What happens in Britain is we do all these things, but we pretend we're not. And we all come home and think we can have a nice cup of tea and a nice little Olympics. The worry about the Olympics, what if the Assad people, I'm not saying they should, what if the Assad people say, you've been causing us a lot of trouble. Perhaps we should mess up your Olympics for you, because that's the only language you understand, isn't it? They've been telling the Free Syrian Army, don't negotiate, don't negotiate, don't negotiate, and the Russians are saying, what's that about? Well, we're telling Assad to negotiate, why aren't you telling the Syrian Army to negotiate? Well, oh, because we want Assad out. Well, he's not going.
What bothers me, Martin, particularly, is our Foreign Secretary actually encouraging actions to be taken outside the UN Security Council, really just to bypass it.
Oh, well, what they do is when the UN does what they want, they clap and cheer and say that's what the UN wants. The UN has demanded that Israel withdraws from the occupied territory since 1967. They've never taken any notice. Perhaps it's about time we put in a no-fly zone over Israel and bomb their army back behind that green line like we did in Bosnia with the Serbs. Perhaps it's about time we all got used to the idea of a world war. Let's go for it. Come on. Let's stop messing around with the Olympics. Let's have a world war, because that's what the West wants. And you know what? They're going to get it if they carry on down this road. And they are playing with fire. It's not just about Syria. It's about the whole region. It's actually a tinderbox of all sorts of antagonisms. And let's just settle it all with weaponry.
I suppose by saying we're going to go outside the UN Security Council, really, William Hague is sticking two fingers up at the Russians and the Chinese, isn't he?
He is indeed. And they represent more than half of humanity between them and their allies. So here we go, World War III. Off we go.
Well, it's I was quite surprised to read that. But anyway, on the subject of Syria, Marina Morris is joining us now, and she's got a report on the subject this week. Hi, Marina.
Hello. This week, Syria has claimed for the first time that it has chemical and biological weapons, which it would use if attacked by outside forces. These weapons are in secure storage guarded by Syria Armed Forces, and they are banned by international treaties which Syria has not ratified. Syria has a land border with Iraq of 375 miles of most desert. Could these be the weapons of mass destruction first used by Iraq's, killing tens of thousands of North Iraqi Kurds used to justify the second Iraq war? One of Iraq's most effective weapons against Western forces during the brief war was Scud missiles, aimed at Israel, seeking to draw Israel into the conflict, whereby destroying Arab support. Syria has a 76 kilometers land border with Israel, so an attack from a desperate regime, even if not directly threatened, it's possible, as is nuclear retaliation. What are these weapons? Basically, a poor man nuclear options. The relatives of the dead don't care that much where their loved ones were shot or gassed, just that they are no longer alive. The British and Germans used poison gas in the trenches during World War I, often mistakenly killing their own troops. Only recently, locally workmen working on the site of the former World War I Mostar gas production facility were taken to hospital, suffering from contamination nearly 100 years later. More recently, the Americans use a chemical weapons, Agent Orange, in Vietnam, and of course nuclear bombs on Japan during World War II. But are these weapons any worse than, for example, the depleted uranium shells used in Iraqi desert to destroy tanks and bunkers, which have left so much of the desert radioactive, and many claims are linked to the health issue both in servicemen and former servicemen, Iraqi civilians, and especially newborn babies in the region? Probably not, but what a great way this to dispose of our waste in someone else's territory. Perhaps it's hypocritical to defend the use of mines, cluster bombs and uranium whilst attacking chemical and biological weapons. All these weapons destroyed habitat and ecosystem for decades to come. Meanwhile, estimates of the number killing during fighting in Syria during the last 16 months, approximately 20,000, and the number of Syrian refugees who have fled abroad has reached 115,000. The situation in Syria is complex, bloody, and likely to be prolonged. Western military intervention would be very risky, and those soldiers about to return from the Afghanistan after they have been used to secure the Olympics have the appointment to join to dull queues in the name of spending cuts. What are the long-term emotional and mental consequences of betraying them, their families and their future? Why should they risk their lives and health again for an ungrateful government? If they want to know how to make real money, sell arms. Who gets them? Ultimately, anyone with the money. Who pays the price? We all do.
Thanks very much, Marina. Martin, I suppose one of the points Marina's making there is, are we getting in a bit of a hoo-ha about chemical weapons in Syria and the potential of Assad to have access to them, when we have actually used these depleted uranium shells in the Gulf and the Gulf War, and Now there's birth defects as a long-term result of this. I mean, isn't there a sort of slight double standards going on here?
Of course there is. I mean, basically, what we're facing here is a kind of information war where people are trying to bend, you know, everybody's trying to make the other side look bad and make themselves look good, and the Syrian government's doing that, and the Syrian government's enemies are doing that. I think Marina's little report there made us aware is ultimately it's ordinary people who suffer in these conflicts. More than 80%, I mean, we were going to have somebody from Oxfam on here today, but they did a study years ago, more than 80% of casualties in modern wars are just random civilians who happen to be in the way. If you fight a gun battle in a built-up area, which is what's going on in Syria, it's virtually inevitable that the people who live there are going to be very seriously injured and killed. And that's exactly what happens. In fact, they're more likely to be killed than people with guns, because people with guns shoot back. It's a terrible mess, and the West, instead of treading carefully and trying to sort of mediate and try and bring about some kind of resolution, is pushing for extreme solutions. And it's quite interesting that the Iraqi government that we put in power at the cost of maybe a million Iraqi lives and hundreds of British servicemen and so on is not backing us on Syria. And if we do go to war with Syria, we might find the Iraqi army coming over the Syrian border to fight the British soldiers who might be sent into Syria. I understand the Americans have got lots of troops in Jordan ready to go. And there's the Press TV are reporting the SAS or ex-SAS, I don't quite sure what the difference is, perhaps we're talking about G4S, are doing the training for the FSA. And if people don't like hearing all these initials, they should think about this is what these wars are like. I remember HOS in Bosnia. Can anybody remember HOS? They were a right wing split of the Croatian National Union. But if you can't remember all the initials and who's fighting who, you shouldn't be involved. And British people who think they know about this but can't remember who the leader of the Liberal Democrats are in their own country should go away and have a word with themselves. We are getting involved here way beyond the level of our depth for the ordinary people. And the people in charge are just leading us by the nose down to another major war, probably worse than Iraq.
But ultimately, somewhere has decided to pay former SAS people, effectively now mercenaries or working for a private military company, hired guns, really. What's the problem with that? I mean, because when you have been trained in the army here, surely once you've finished in the army, you can just go out and take any job.
Well, my view would be that training is not transferable to anybody, ever. We don't train people to kill so that they can go and sell it to the highest bidder. And of course, what I would say to those mercenaries in there earning money is you deserve a bullet in the head, and I hope the Syrian army get you. And in fact, if you read the international press, they've actually captured quite a few of these mercenaries, and what they've been doing with them is bargaining with them and handing them back.
Actually, I think
the
they've just had released a few today, in fact.
Indeed they have. And the Syrian army is saying, stop sending your mercenaries to kill our people. What would you think if we did that to you? You wouldn't like it, would you? We don't like it. And
now,
they're right.
Okay, so do you think this is part of the rise of the private military company? These PMCs, you're talking about your acronyms, yes. but the PMCs, what does this mean for the modern world?
Well, what's happening is that the Homeland Security in the US, I understand, has now got a million employees. It didn't exist before 9/11. What's happening is the creation of a huge grey area where William Hague can say that we're not training the rebels, but ex-SAS people are, and somebody's paying for it. Who would that be? Probably the Saudis or the Israelis. Now, the point is that he knows very well that British personnel are being used in that way, but there's a cutout because they're a private military company. He can pretend that it's nothing to do with us, and that's the whole point. And we're coming on to discuss Gladio and what went on in Italy in the 70s and the 80s later in the show. And, of course, it's all run through these kind of networks of corrupt military and financial linkages. And, of course, the people at the front can always stand up and say, oh, it's nothing to do with us. It's all happening in the shadows.
So
of course, it is to do with us.
Is it only national governments that pay these organisations?
There's all sorts of people out there with money, drug cartels, all sorts of people. But I can bet your bottom dollar, those SAS guys, even if they are... working independently, will have cleared it with the British government before they went, because they wouldn't do it otherwise. Because if they didn't clear it with the British government, they wouldn't be helped out if they got into trouble. Now, that's the way it works, and it's pernicious. It's very pernicious.
But then it's
if you're a soldier, you serve the state, not some private sector paymaster.
Are you saying it's deniable then? Exactly. If anyone comes to William Hague and says, hang on a minute, you know, you've sent this guy over there, you can say,
oh, nothing to do with me, nothing to do with me. The Qataris paid for these chaps. But what I would say is they're actually acting illegally inside Syria under international law. And if they're captured, they're not to be treated as prisoners of war. They're to be treated as criminals, which includes, no doubt, in Syria, the death penalty. So perhaps we need to see a couple of SAS guys electrocuted on television in Damascus to get the message through to the middle-class people in Britain that you don't go around picking wars in other people's countries because you can get hurt. You can, and you will.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now, on to some of the possible blowback from this conflict in the Middle East, and that we ask the question now, will there be a bomb at the Olympics? The army have made that much less likely than the situation was before the G4S shambles. But nevertheless, if the unthinkable happens, who might benefit? Well, Martin, I've got a little list here, and you might want to add to it. First of all, Al-Qaeda, might they do it?
Well, look, I mean, the questions here about what is Al-Qaeda? Al-Qaeda, for example, the Libyan franchise of Al-Qaeda was the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who were the Schwerpunkt of the attack for this rebellion last year in Libya. They've been working with Western intelligence for years to try and kill Gaddafi, as David Shaler and Annie Machon pointed out in the 1990s. But in actual fact, there's no secret about the fact that Al-Qaeda has cooperated closely with Western intelligence services all along, not just in the 80s, but now. It's now becoming very clear that that's what's going on. I mean, it was an Islamic fighting group that claimed responsibility for killing these three generals in Syria, and now we find out that they had some kind of training and backing from Western intelligence services. Can't people put two and two together yet? I tell you who can put two and two together. It's Vladimir Putin, the ex-KGB agent. He knows what they're up to, and he's not standing for it.
So,
and people have got to wake up to where we've arrived at.
Okay, so it's unlikely to be Al-Qaeda. That's what I'm getting from you.
Well, Al-Qaeda might do because, it, but it would be part of the whole thing of getting the war on terror going so we can invade Syria.
Okay, yeah? Because actually at the moment, Britain is their ally in Syria, you know, so there is...
Yes, but there's a cognitive dissonance.
Okay,
here.
Can we just work on a sort of superficial level here,
okay,
first
on
of
a
all?
Superficial
then
level.
We can maybe take it down a little bit. What about, let's say, for example, another alignment, which is the Muslim Brotherhood? Have they got any kind of interest
the
in
Muslim
Britain
Brotherhood
at the moment?
Have no interest in doing it. The Muslim Brotherhood are struggling to try and become a democratic political force in most countries in the Middle East, but also, of course, they're working quite closely with the Americans on the economy. So these alliances are like a kaleidoscope. Yeah, your enemies today can be your friends tomorrow, and there's more than two sides. There's all sorts of different factions out there, and it's more complicated than people think. The Muslim Brotherhood would be most... Do you know who's most likely to benefit? Let's just cut to the chase. If there was an attack on the Olympics, my first thing in my mind would be it's the Western intelligence services. That would be my first number one suspect. Now, it might be that I'd be wrong, but they'd be my number one suspect because they usually are.
It was very interesting, I thought, to see, and possibly he should be sacked for misconduct in public office for saying this, but the Director General of MI5, a few days after our scoop about a month ago with Ben Fellows at the Olympics, actually came out publicly, one of his rare occasions, told everyone in Britain through Simon Israel on Channel 4 News that all of the security, no one needed to worry, everything was fine and safe at the Olympics. Then we subsequently, over a week or so later, after he made that announcement, have found that the whole thing was a shambles.
Well, not only that, he said, and the main threat comes from the Iranians. And I see no threat whatsoever from the Iranians to attack the Olympics. They've already said we've got no interest in that whatsoever. Why would we do such a silly thing?
Well, that's
we've now got an Israeli team based in Britain hunting down supposed Iranian terrorists that are going to attack our Olympics. An Israeli team. I can't remember where I read that. It wasn't in the British press. Now, I would suggest that the Israelis, in fact, are prime suspects. This bomb in Bulgaria, the Iranian foreign minister is saying, that bomb in Bulgaria, you killed a number of Jewish citizens of Israel there. That wasn't us. That was you. And we've got evidence of you behaving like that for years and years and years, killing your own people in order to get everybody going because you want a war. The right wing in Israel have been doing it for years. Yitzhak Shamir, who was the man of peace, shot dead by a lone gunman. And the security services did nothing because, in actual fact, it was probably them behind it. Now, this is the way the real world works. The people out there are gangsters. The Western powers are gangsters. Assad's a gangster. Maybe Putin's a gangster. But the problem with the West is they're pussy gangsters. That, in actual fact, they can't actually walk the talk. And if they carry on down the road and start a major war in the Middle East, I hope they lose. And I'm pretty certain they will. But, of course, the costs will be appalling.
Okay, on to another potential culprit, if there is a bomb at the Olympics of some sort, the Palestinians, because we remember that they attacked the Munich Olympics.
Well, yes, except that the Black September group that was supposedly responsible was working with Abu Nidal, who was based in Baghdad. Many people believe that Abu Nidal was always working for Mossad. And, of course, they were actually given safe houses. It was said by the German Secret Service that they'd been given safe houses by the Red Army faction. It turns out the Palestinian terrorists had been given safe houses by neo-Nazi terrorists, which the head of the German secret police has had to resign recently because they were covering up for them for years.
That's how it's from.
So, in other words, even Munich, the Munich attack on Israeli athletes, that may have been carried out by Western intelligence services in order to demonise the Palestinians. Sounds bizarre, but once you get the pattern, it all becomes clear. When you hear of a terrorist attack, don't presume you know who did it. I mean, with the IRA, you knew where you were because P. O'Neill would issue a statement saying, yes, we did it, or no, we didn't do it, because that were the rules when the IRA were fighting the British. And you could be pretty confident that the IRA would own up if they'd done something, because that was part of their strategy, was to issue a press release after every attack. But, of course, what goes on in the real world, wider than that, is all sorts of things go on to discredit people. People have nasty accidents. All sorts of stuff goes on. That's the real world.
Okay, what about the Russians and the Chinese then? Are they getting any interest? Is they're getting rather annoyed with Britain right now at the United Nations,
aren't they see this use of terrorism as a major problem because it's a Western technique. I'm not saying that the Russians and the Chinese don't engage in terrorism. They do. But they basically do it within their own sphere of influence, if they do it at all. And in actual fact, they've got quite authoritarian states, so they don't have to bother. They just tell people what to do, and people do it. In the West, where we've got a semi-democracy, people have to be frightened into doing things. That's why we've got such a track record of state-sponsored terrorism.
The Iranian government, because obviously there's a lot of trouble with the Iranians right now. Israelis are alleging.
Oh, yes. Well, it was front page of the Telegraph. Israel fears Iranian attack on the Olympics.
And the Sunday Times last weekend.
Sunday Times, was it? Well, what I read from that is, I fear an Israeli attack on the Olympics. We know at 7-7 that Benjamin Netanyahu had a warning because it was in the Jerusalem Post, and they are definitely suspects for 7-7. They're also suspects for 9-11, the five dancing Israelis that were captured by the New York police, basically filming the event and clapping and cheering. They were all released. It was all based in a moving company, a removals company called... Urban Moving Systems, which turned out to be a Mossad cover organisation. Mossad basically are major suspects. They go around killing people, as they did in that guy in Doha. Was it Doha? What am I talking about? Dubai. And they just blatantly say, yes, we did that. Ha 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 ha.
Well, it was all recorded on CCTV in the hotel.
They are a terrorist state. And I would fear that what the Israelis might do is plant a bomb, small or big, at the Olympics and say it was the Iranians because they want a war with Iran. They've made no secret of that. They're shouting from the rooftops, let's have a war with Iran. Let's not hang around. Let's get on with it. Now, people have got to realise, because most people in Britain really live in a bit of a bubble, and all of this is going on, and we've got our fingers in all these pies all over the world. Nobody in Iran is in any doubt that we're about to go to war with them, but most people in Britain are oblivious. And we went to see Stephen Williams to talk about this a few weeks ago, who's a Liberal Democrat MP, and he just voted to keep war on the table. And we feel like saying, take it off the table and put it under your chair, because nobody in Britain is at all interested in a war with Iran, but the political elite are talking themselves into it. And I felt like saying, have you got a strategy for a war with Iran? Because you claim you say you want one at a certain point if they don't do X, Y, or Z. What are you going to do to them? Have you thought about what they might do to you? And you suddenly get this kind of blank look, because people in Britain like the idea of war, and we always win, like the Falklands and all the rest of it. And then you suddenly ask them, well, what are you going to do when such and such happens, or so and so happens? And they suddenly say, actually, we don't want a war, do we? And most British people, of course, they don't want a war, but they're not in charge.
But, I mean, haven't they got a sort of sense of confidence from Afghanistan, Iraq, and these other places where they've got what they wanted?
Well, no, they haven't really got
what
they
wanted. Well, they have, because they've got reconstruction contracts, they've got oil contracts, etc.
The ordinary folk have got nothing from any of that, nor have the ordinary people who serve in the military.
Well, which is what I'm saying. You know, if they have actually got fantastic amounts of money from these conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., well, of course they're going to be looking at maybe extending that.
We are dealing with a criminal elite which has lost its moral bearings. And the only thing blocking them, and it is blocking them, is don't forget there is a Russian aircraft carrier sitting there saying, don't try a no-fly zone over here, or you will have to try and take on our pilots. Okay? And they couldn't make the signal any clearer. And that, of course, could happen. The Turkish jets could end up fighting the Russian jets. The British boys are already on the ground inside the free, fighting with the Free Syrian Army. What if one of those British boys is captured by the Syrian Army? Is he a prisoner of war, or should he be executed? What do you think?
Well, we are very much hoping there'll be no events, and I think it's probably likely now, at least we've got some proper security at the Olympics, that
exactly.
There won't be.
Exactly. Having proper security run by the police and the army is the safest thing. Not entirely safe, but having private companies doing it, well, that's asking for trouble, frankly.
But, I mean, Martin, if something does happen, when the mainstream media tell us who it was, how can we tell who really did it?
Well, what you've always said, Tony, and I think it's very important, if you really want to investigate these things, what you should do is switch on your recording devices, whether it's MP3s or whatever it is, record everything that's said in the first 24
hours. Yeah, your VHS video, whatever it happens to be, a DVD recorder or whatever.
What usually happens in the first 24 hours is all sorts of stories start to circulate, which then die in the second 24 hours once the story has been straightened out. And that's how we've looked into both 7/7 and 9/11. We've listened to all of the stuff from the first 24 hours. So in the first 24 hours of 9/11, you've got the BBC journalist saying to camera, well, WTC7 has collapsed. We've just heard that WTC7 has collapsed. This is the third building that collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon. And there's actually a picture of WTC7 behind her. It hasn't collapsed. It did collapse 2 minutes later. Now, how does a BBC journalist know 2 minutes before the building's going to collapse that it's going to collapse? Because somebody has told her it's collapsed, and she got it wrong. She said it has collapsed, and then it did collapse. And it collapsed because it was bombed, not because any plane flew into it, and it wasn't bombed by Al-Qaeda. Now, people have got to wake up and understand who the enemy is. We are at war with these people, and it's already started. Time to wake up.
Now, the other aspect to all this, of course, is that quite a lot of the Olympics, including this 9 o'clock tonight's opening ceremony and the closing ceremony, will be watched by millions. Actually, tonight, they reckon 1 billion people will be watching the opening ceremony of the Olympics. Can you just explain this whole sort of shock doctrine business of actually doing something at an event like that and the power that it has because there's so many people watching it?
Well, I mean, the obvious fear has got to be with 1 billion people watching, if you are trying to create an effect, whether you're a freelance terrorist or an intelligence agency, say Mossad, it's the perfect place to do it. But that's why the security has to be so tight. And I don't mean worrying about people with beards in Afghanistan. I mean getting G4S out. G4S, for example, got a massive program in Israel. They run prisons, which have got thousands of political prisoners in, all run by G4S. Are you happy for an Israeli-based company with all that politics behind it to be running the security at the Olympics? Because I'm not. ICTS is another Israeli-based company who ran all three airports on 9/11 and ran Schiphol Airport, where the shoe bomber and the so-called underpants bomber got on the plane, even though the underpants bomber for sure didn't go through any security checks, because we've got eyewitnesses saying so. Now, if you are running the security and you're the private security and you are the terrorist, then it's actually very easy to stage terrorist attacks and blame other people, because you are the security. That's why you shouldn't have privatised security. Who's first in the queue? It's Israeli security companies, because they're the experts. They're certainly the experts. They're certainly the experts, but they shouldn't be running anything. They shouldn't be allowed anywhere near any kind of security in this country.
Now, Naomi Klein did a book called The Shock Doctrine, which looks at some of the sort of psychology behind these kind of public TV terror events. How does that actually affect a big population?
Well, to be fair, Naomi Klein was talking more about the way that disaster capitalism gets on the back of things like the tsunami or the earthquake in Haiti or what happened with Hurricane Katrina. So she doesn't in fact talk about terrorism, although she does talk about Israeli security companies. There's a lot about that, because of course the more chaos there is, the Israelis have cornered the market in security. They've developed certain weapons so you can shoot round a corner with one of their guns. Yeah, then they've developed all of this stuff, and it's one of the biggest industries in Israel. But they shouldn't be allowed to sell their stuff to anybody, because they are the potential terrorists.
Well,
to be blocked out.
The thing that bothers me is we hear quite a lot nowadays about how high-tech industries are going to pick us up out of the recession. Well, do they mean this kind of high-tech industry?
I think they do. And I think this is the potential for this criminalised elite that are running the West to actually start a war in order to cover their tracks is actually quite high, sadly.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Okay, before we leave this subject of the Olympics completely, the sponsorship of the Olympics, Martin, we've several companies such as Dow Chemicals who are involved there. They took over the company that was responsible for the Bhopal disaster in India. We've got fast food giants, McDonald's, and BMWs as well. I mean, at the end of the day, the original Olympics back in ancient Greece were a sort of homage to the gods Zeus. What about these current Olympics? Because back in 1948, when London last held the Olympics, it was a completely different story. It was called the Austerity Olympics. This time, it's almost all pure corporate sponsorship.
Well, you know what?
And actually, I heard someone today say that without this sponsorship, the Olympics could never have happened. And I don't believe a word of it.
Well, without the public, the British taxpayer, the Olympics couldn't have happened. I hope people out there are happy, because you're going to be paying $9 billion towards this. Nobody ever makes any money on the Olympics, and Britain basically we're in a hole financially, supposedly, and we're not going to make any money on this at all. They're talking about the Olympics boosting our GDP. I wonder whether it will. We'll see.
What about the morals, though, of which companies they accept for the sponsorship and which they don't? I mean, it doesn't seem to matter. It's just, ultimately, if they can come up with the money, it doesn't matter who you are. Yes, you can sponsor the Olympics. You can have your logo on everything. Don't you think that there's a sort of greenwashing going on here, where companies love these sorts of events? You know, whatever their bad image might be, they can come and get it sanitised at an Olympic
event. Well, as our undercover chap Ben Fellows was saying, they were told explicitly that people turn up at the Olympics with T-shirts advertising things that are from sponsors who are not actually, you know, people who are not sponsors. They're to take the T-shirts off, otherwise they can't go in.
Turn them round and put them back
but
on.
But don't forget, sport as a whole has become corrupted by money. I mean, look at the people protesting outside Manchester United yesterday, I think it was, about the club being massively in debt because the people who took it over, bought it on the Never Never, and one of the most successful football teams in the world is in financial crisis because of these swindlers. That's just the way it's working, isn't it?
Now, for me, probably the most despicable one of the sponsors is BMW's, the company which was bought by the Quant family after World War II. The Quant family having owned a company called ABB right through the war, who used concentration camp victims to do all their labour for them, basically to make batteries for the Nazi Navy, the submarines, the tanks. And essentially, this money was made on the backs of people who, if they died on the job, would just, the SS would march somebody else along and replace them, Martin.
Well, yes, but I mean, all of these companies, I mean, if you think about all the Japanese major companies that we all know so well, Mitsubishi and so on, the Mitsubishi Zero was used in the kamikaze attacks.
You could say the same for, say, for example, Volkswagen, but the difference is Volkswagen have paid millions to the reparation funds for the families of the victims. So there's been a financial fessing up, in a way, by Mercedes, Porsche, and many of these other German companies. Now, this particular company, BMW and ABB, there has been none of that. In fact, there was a 2008. There was a 2008 documentary in Germany, it was a complete surprise because they were afraid of it being pulled if the Quant family got wind of it. Called The Silence of the Quants, and you can actually watch it on YouTube if you read German. I don't think there's an English translation. It's certainly never been shown in Britain. But what it shows is that ultimately, the wealth, every penny that's made from the BMWs is going into this same family, and that they have simply remained silent on all of the as people are pointing the finger at them and saying, well, you've made all this wealth that you've now used to create this company on the backs of basically piling up bodies in your factories.
Well, yes, I mean, the BMW may have a particularly bad record, but don't forget, all German companies, we reviewed the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning on this show a few weeks ago, and he was pointing out that a lot of the German companies were indirectly controlled by Nazi money, even at the end of the war. They took all the money offshore and then they brought it all back. And basically, a lot of the money paid to the Israelis by German companies led to a situation where the Israelis laid off their hunt for Nazi war criminals in South America, because basically they've been paid off. All in the book. Very hard to get hold of, but a very interesting
read. Well, it's
actually
very easy to get hold of. You can get it as a free download, as a PDF file, if you just search.
Well worth a read.
Search for Martin Bormann, that's BORMANN, and he was Hitler's deputy. Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. You'll find it straight away. Now, on the subject of BMW, all these new BMW Minis, I find a bit irksome, that go around nowadays, because they've basically taken the entire Mini concept and brought it up into this sort of new BMW style version. It's actually really sort of picking up on the old ideas and all the sort of kudos that goes with the gorgeous old Mini, and turned it into this now BMW machine. Last week I spoke to a guy called Martin Nutland, and he's it's going to be published in a couple of months actually, just about finished his book called Brick by Brick, The Man Who Really Built the Mini. So let's have a listen to him now. The guy who really built the Mini was called Leonard Lord. He was in charge of of BNC and Leylands. So here's my little chat I had with Martin Nutland.
British Leyland was formed in 1967-1968, and the saga after that, which led to Austin Rover, then the BMW debacle, and so on, until the thing disappeared altogether.
BMWs, I mean, they produced their own Mini.
This isn't really the Mini as we knew it. Of course, they are trading on the iconic status of the original Mini, which really had the image of fun and chic and glamorous people wanting them and owning them. Three of the Beatles, at least, people like Marianne Faithfull, Peter Sellers, Britt Eklund, Lord Snowden, Princess Margaret. The Queen even drove one, not as her car, but was seen driving one, trying one out. And Prince Charles, although he's too young to drive on the roads at the time, was given one on which to learn to drive. So that's what BMW have bought into, if you like, that image, that iconic status, and retained the name for that very reason. But you're absolutely correct when you say that the Mini, as we see it on the streets today, is very little to do with the Mini of those days. I mean, don't mention the war sort of situation. But interestingly, I mean, we might speculate as to the thing which really triggered Lord in the direction of the Mini was the Suez Crisis. And when the Suez Crisis developed in 1956 and petrol was rationed again and petrol prices went up, one of the short-term solutions, if you like, was the emergence of the bubble car. We had cars, again, BMW were prominent in making bubble cars, but also firms like Heinkel and Messerschmitt, names which we, as British people, we associate with the Second World War and fighter aircraft. You might pose the question, was Lord so motivated in getting out the Mini? And he said, you know, we want to drive those bubble cars off the road and build proper cars. One wonders if part of his motivation was that he was irked to see cars called Heinkel and Messerschmitt taking a share of the market. People do resent the money that was made by those companies out of the slave labor and an attitude where the labor force was utterly dispensable. If they dropped dead on the job, you censor them more. The book is called Brick by Brick, the biography of the man who really made the Mini, Leonard Lord, and it should be out in August.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And that was Martin Nutland. Now, 30 years ago, a young woman was stopped at the customs hall of Rome Airport. While customs officers were searching her suitcase, they discovered documents inside a false lining. As they read through them, their eyes widened. This was the proof of what the Italians had long suspected. Plans of the Grand Orient Masonic Order of Italy to take over newspapers and political parties, etc., etc., in what they called the plan to renew democracy. Well, it was, of course, nothing of the sort, but a programme to destroy the rising Communist Party and reintroduce a Mussolini-style rule by fear. The Masons had been running an invisible parallel government of traitors and would use their own secret services, military intelligence, to kidnap and kill their political rivals, kill their own people, and fit up for these high-level political assassinations domestic left-wing radicals and the Russians. Well, this document has been translated by a human into English for the first time. It's online today. Martin, first of all, this P2 Lodge, of this which this document was part of, what were they all about?
Well, I mean, I'm just glancing through the document here. I mean, P2 was basically a Freemason lodge at the heart of the Italian state, and it was used as a kind of linkage between financial interests, Western intelligence services, including the Italian intelligence services, the mafia, the fascists, and various terrorist activities that went on in Italy during the 70s and the 80s. So, you know, the usual red thread, if you like, links financial terrorists with actual terrorists based in the intelligence services.
I mean, I find the whole thing a little bit spooky because they had all of the regional heads of the police as part of this lodge. They used to meet about every 2 weeks and they were effectively a parallel government. They were running alongside the existing government and actually really telling them what to do. They had agents who were in politics, they had people who were in the police and people who were in the media. So they had a completely different agenda to the democratically elected government.
Well, the democratically elected government of Aldo Moro, who was the Christian Democrat Prime Minister in 1979, before this document was found, it looks as if he was kidnapped not by the Red Brigades, but by...
Now, the Red Brigades, just for a minute, they were a sort of lefty group.
They were a left-wing
the
terrorist group who were basically manipulated by the intelligence services. Some people in it, like in Al-Qaeda, thought that they were genuine communist terrorists, but in actual fact, the leadership had been suborned by the intelligence services. So the Red Brigades were used... Aldo Moro was setting off to invite the Communist Party into a coalition government in Italy for the first time since the 19... for the first time ever. And basically he was saying, look, you've got, you know, 30-40% of the vote, why don't we just do a deal, what was called the historic compromise, the Compromiso Storico, between, you know, Catholic interests and communist interests. And if some people may have read the Little World of Don Camillo, in actual fact there was a possibility of decent Catholics and moderate communists forming a government. But they never did, because Aldo Moro didn't get to Parliament. He was kidnapped supposedly by the Red Brigades, but of course subsequently it transpired. It's actually this P2 lodge that got him kidnapped. And of course he was held for ransom for several days, or tens of days, and then he was assassinated, killing off any possibility of such political developments. And that, of course, is what was going on behind the scenes. So the Prime Minister of Italy murdered by this P2 lodge. And Andreotti, who was a subsequent Prime Minister, put on trial 3 times by the Italian police as a mafia don, not as just collaborating with the mafia, but as a mafia chief, got off every time because these people have good lawyers. But the fact of the matter is that criminals have been running the Italian state for years. Criminals have been running this state for years because the British intelligence services and the US intelligence services were in the stuff going on in Italy up to their eyeballs.
Now, one of the things that puzzles me is to what extent was what the Grand Orient Freemasonry structure was doing in Italy, to what extent was that actually in their own interest in Italy, or to what extent was it actually in league with, say, for example, the Americans? Because I know that they had a very strong fears that communism in Italy was going to tip Italy more towards the Russians than towards them.
Well, in fact, the Communist Party in Italy condemned the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, so they were Euro-communists. They just didn't like the idea of any change in Italy. And in actual fact, I think the Italians could quite understand the possibility of getting a coalition government between the Christian Democrats and the Communists. In fact, that would have quite suited a lot of people and it would have been quite a sensible thing to do. But it didn't happen, mainly because the Americans and the British, their usual sidekicks, made sure it didn't happen. So when we say all this terrible stuff was going on in Italy, who was pulling the strings? The strings were being pulled in Washington and in London.
Okay, now what about this particular programme? I mean, what they've got here is a lot of... In fact, I've found it actually staggering to see how much of this is devoted to newspapers and television networks. I mean, it actually does talk about particular networks which they control, and other TV networks and newspaper that they don't control, even names specific journalists in some cases. Why do you think this obsession with the press, this Masonic organisation, was so keen on taking over the press?
Well, it's all about perception management, isn't it? Why are all the rebels in Syria trying to tug our heartstrings by murdering people and claiming it's the government? It's all about perceptions. And of course, the whole basis of this was what was known as the strategy of tension.
Just a minute.
The strategy of tension.
Surely it doesn't matter what the perceptions are. It's what's going on the ground that counts. It doesn't matter if the media is coming out with something that's a total illusion. Surely it doesn't matter, does it?
Well, the point is that the media have to be relied upon to tell the correct story when you've carried out... The purpose of kidnapping the Prime Minister or bombing Bologna Railway Station is to terrify the population and terrify the political class appropriately. And therefore, you need the media to then amplify that, so you've got a be sure that they will actually tell the narrative that you want them to hear. Oh, these terrible left-wing terrorists have kidnapped the Prime Minister. In actual fact, it's the State Secret Services that have kidnapped the Prime Minister. As was all made clear in Frankovic's documentary shown on BBC Two in 1993, although they're only ever shown once, and he interviewed everybody. The actual people concerned were confessing to camera about what they did. But that's to say, only shown once but available on the internet.
Now, you said that this kind of thing could happen here in Britain. Now, this is this particular P2 lodge is part of what's called Grand Orient Freemasonry, which is prevalent in Italy and France, for example, which is largely atheistic. Our Grand Lodge, based in London here, the Freemasons in Britain, that has a more of a Christian characteristic, which is there any real difference? Do you think it's really impossible for this sort of thing to happen
in
Britain?
I think if people think of this as Freemasonry, they're missing the point. Elites will always have their clubs. They always will. And they'll call them what they'll call them. P2 was a very elite club, and Freemasonry was used as the vehicle. But if Freemasonry didn't exist, something else would be invented for these people to get together and do their nefarious things. Elites always stick together and always look after each other. Now, and if people step out of line, they get punished.
Have you got any evidence of that? And how do you think things really work behind the scenes here in Britain? Well, because we talked earlier on about the sort of government by the millionaires for the millionaires. Do you think there's actually some sort of more formal invisible government in Britain rather than just a set of interests around the cabinet table?
We'll have a look who goes from Britain to Bilderberg, and you'll probably have a fairly good idea of who the insiders and the outsiders are. We saw Tony Blair, who denied being a Bilderberger, but it turned out that he did go to Bilderberg. There you go. He tells an outright lie. I didn't go to Bilderberg, but he did. He's now a multimillionaire. And surprise, surprise, he thinks that we're bashing up too much on the bankers. And he'd like to be leader of the Labour Party again and lead us all back into the centrist ground where we're nice to bankers. Because bankers have been nice to him, so he wants us all to be nice to the bankers. Delusionary. Delusionary.
OK, Martin, thanks very much. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night. Kicking off with the Fresh Blood Party. I know Pat Hart is actually out in the Caribbean at the moment, so it won't be him. But anyway, they will be on the next couple of hours. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That's the Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Jeff Gollop. And, of course, to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, who's taking a few weeks off. We'll have Robin Clapp from the Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance over the next few weeks. Next week, we're looking at hospital PFIs going bankrupt, and also many patients now apparently dying of dehydration. So if you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this program's 5-point economic recovery plan. Just go to bcfm.org.uk and find this show, or even easier, go to thisweek.org.uk, which takes you straight to this show and to our archives. A podcast of this show is available online about 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Our music this week is from The Clash, and this is called Armageddon Time. Do please join us for Friday drive time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
People won't get no supper tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. And the battle is getting hard in this Irish Armageddon tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. Remember to kick it off. No one will guide you on Gideon time.
Logistics, your community courier.